I'm Callie Crossley. This is Boston Public Radio. Today we're going regional, stepping away from Boston and the Beltway to look at the news, the local news, coming out of Rhode Island, the Granite State, and the Cape. Joining us today are Paul Pronovost of the Cape Cod Times, Robert Whitcomb with the Providence Journal, and New Hampshire's Arnie Arneson, host of The Attitude on WNHN, right here in Studio 3 today.
You bet, honey.
It's good to see you all and to hear from all of you. Hey there.
Voice activated.
Okay. Just want to make sure you're there. Paul, I want to start off with you because we've been talking a lot of gambling news this week. So much is happening in and around the Boston area and Western Massachusetts. And now this latest, it seems like a big blow to the Wampanoag, the Mashpee Wampanoags bid to get their casino off the ground.
Yeah, well, I mean, the so-called carcieri fix, which is a legislative maneuver that would allow them to have land taken into trust, has not happened, despite the fact that Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said he was going to try to move this forward this week. He then recanted and said they're still negotiating, and so it's basically stalled. And why this is important is it will allow the tribe to take land into a federal trust, which would allow them to build a casino. And of course, they have plans to build a $500 million casino in Taunton. The tribe maintains they don't need this to happen, that they can do it anyway, but it certainly would help pave the way to making the casino a go, at least faster, because if they don't do this, inevitably they're going to face legal challenges, which of course would slow things down even more for them. And as we know, this is almost like a space race. I mean, there are, as you said, Callie, there's a number of folks out there who have casino proposals. Really, there's going to be a saturation of the market, so the folks who get up and going first are going to have a distinct advantage. And that's why the tribe hopes that they're the ones.
Now, Paul, do they have financing? I mean, how accessible is financing to the tribe?
The money at this point,
because they aren't going to run it or finance it, obviously.
Well, right, they borrowed a lot of money. They've gotten money. They borrowed a lot.
That's part of their problem.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Sure. I mean, they have obviously deep-pocketed investors who have roots all the way from Las Vegas to Malaysia, and these
but
are folks
who
run.
How secure is that? I probably should have phrased that. How secure is that financing?
Sure.
What will
sure.
it take for the financial backers to run away?
I think at this point people still feel pretty confident, at least the backers feel confident that the Mashpee Wampanoags are a safe bet. They've certainly lost their pole position. I mean, they had really raced out into the lead, and we all recall when Governor Patrick negotiated with them, and it seemed like they were just steamrolling ahead. And then, of course, the Fed said, well, the deal you struck with the governor is no good because you were giving away too much, and now this. And so, really, at a minimum, they're even with some of the other folks like Steve Wynn coming out from Las Vegas talking to the mayor in Everett earlier
Everett
this week.
Of all places. Boy, that's hard to say. Oh. That is really hard
but
to
Paul,
say.
But, Paul, I have a question because the second to last line in your article says, the land issue is significant to the tribe because at any time the Massachusetts Gaming Commission can put the Southern Massachusetts casino license out to competitive bid if it determines the tribe has exhausted its federal options. When do we say exhaustion? That's my only question.
Right. Well,
critical because who gets to define exhaustion?
And that's a debate that's happening in the legislature.
Yeah, the U.S. Supremes. Oh, no.
No, I think, I mean, maybe eventually, but at this point at least, it still rests in the legislature.
Right.
And there are some who have, frankly, been against the casino for the Mashpee Wampanoags from the beginning, feeling that it should always have been a competitive bid and they shouldn't have had an inside track, which they did. And so there are folks, especially lawmakers in southeastern Massachusetts, the New Bedford and Fall River area, where they want to have sort of the economic shot in the arm in their area. And they say, enough, tick-tock. We need to get it away from the Mashpee Wampanoag and build it somewhere else.
Right.
So far, that hasn't gained enough momentum to do anything. So exhausted, quote-unquote, still remains an open term.
Okay. I nominate Edgartown as the best site.
No, that'll never
happen. I'm sure they'll listen to you.
No, that
won't
be happening.
I'm sure.
Paul, something that was raised in your piece is that Senator Daniel Akaka, who's a Democrat from Hawaii, who's a retiring chair of the Senate Indian Affairs Committee, has been pushing this and wanted it to get done before he retired. Do we have any sense of why this was a big issue for him?
Yeah, well, I think that he's been on this committee for a long time, the Senate Indian Affairs Committee, and this ruling, which dates back to Rhode Island's Governor Don Carcieri, who had sort of a beef with the Narragansett tribe, and the Supreme Court ruled essentially that tribes, it basically stopped tribes from doing what the Mashpee Wampanoag are intending to do, which is take land into trust.
Right.
So when that happened,
trust,
right, and that put the brakes on tribes across the country. And I think Senator Akaka wants to not retire before this issue is at least resolved somehow. And so he's pushing for it. On the other side, you have folks like Senator Dianne Feinstein, who really want major renovation revisions done to what she considers a loophole, where tribes can basically shop for casinos and place them wherever they feel is
and
best.
And this is the real problem. That it, this is exactly what it is. It is a loophole. You know how we all hate earmarks? Well, this is like this is an earmark, a loophole, everything we absolutely abhor. And the problem is that you're also facing the fiscal cliff. And if I were Harry Reid, I'd be sitting here going, I don't know. Why would I want to take this one on when I've got this other problem that I have at my a gun to my head?
Right.
So it's gonna be a challenge for them. And I think the biggest challenge for them, however, is the fact that they can't come to consensus with the governor about what the cut should be for the state. That to me is huge.
And that's an ongoing, lingering issue that they've yet to resolve.
But I think they would work that out if, and particularly there may be pressure to work that out, given that now we've got three proposals in Springfield, one in Palmer, one in Everett. On a chemical dump, by the way. I mean, it's so intense now in Massachusetts.
How perfect.
You know, that it's really competitive now.
So one last question, Paul. What does the Bureau of Indian Affairs say is a legitimate cut for the state? Because remember, the Wampanoag said yes. Deval said yes. And then it was this third party. Now the question is, what are the parameters of that third party? Because that means they can trump whatever negotiation they get to.
Right, and I don't think that's well defined because I think the actual percentage is not the whole picture. You know, you could add in other things that have of value, not just strict dollars. And frankly, the tribe and the governor thought they had done that.
Exactly.
The fact that Governor Patrick was going to negotiate, or not negotiate, but perhaps lobby on their behalf with his friend, President Obama, to the tribe, felt like a pretty good deal. Yeah. But clearly the Bureau of Indian Affairs didn't agree.
Well, that's just to put a button on this, is just to prove that this whole gambling thing can change in a minute, because Steve Wynn was out, now he's back. I mean, you know, I have a feeling that we're going to see a lot more shifting sand before it's all over.
It's a crapshoot.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
All right. Well, that definitely is the end of this conversation. All right, let's move on to you, Arnie, right here with me in Studio 3. The skinny pancake livable wage controversy.
Oh,
this is really very interesting, aside from the kind of funny name of this restaurant, but this is a serious, serious story.
Well, back about almost a decade ago, the city of Burlington decided that they wanted to have a livable wage for people that were going to either contract with the city or city employees. And the living wage was determined to be, and it was going to change over time. Today it's $13.94, and if you don't include health benefits, it's $17.10. And so obviously, they have an airport, and the skinny pancake guys competed for this contract to be at the airport. And there's confusion about what was said at the time of the contract. That's the big problem. They weren't clear. Were they going to be exempt from this livable wage? Were they going to have to live with a livable wage? And everybody has a different sort of impression of this. No matter what happened, they were given an exemption from the livable wage, and people are apoplectic because they said, wait a minute, as soon as you erode this exemption for this group, then it'll be for the next group. And then what's the point? There is no livable wage. And so the guy was saying, oh, but you have to understand the skinny pancake. What we do is we use local produce and local maple syrup, and we're supporting all these local farmers.
Well,
you
no
want
to do it. Yeah.
Of course. I mean, I have my violin
it's
out,
bonkers.
Too.
Yeah.
I mean, the problem is that he wants to give them, you know, a skinny paycheck. And that's, I think, part of the problem. And so there's virtue on both sides, because obviously he's concerned about what's going to happen to his profits, and he'd have to charge $20 for a sandwich, and
so
all
he says.
Those issues. So he said, exactly.
Yeah, right.
And no
is
one
it
is
highly profitable, Arnie? So far as you can tell, does this place make a lot of money?
Well, no.
I know it's closely held, so they don't have to sell it.
Exactly right. They're closely held. And apparently, Brugger's and Dunkin' Donuts and a couple of other people competed for this. They were willing to negotiate the livable wage thing and say that they would comply with that. But let's also remember something else. when you're a huge institution like a Dunkin' Donuts or a Brugger's, you can sort of shift some of your money around. Mm-hmm. When you're a smaller operation like Skinny Pancakes, where you have only two or three shops, it's more difficult to do that. At the same time, if everybody that's paying at the Burlington Airport is paying that livable wage, then, you know, why you? You know, and if they can find someone else.
What are the criteria for setting the, you know, the livable wage? What's a livable wage in Vermont? I mean, what, where does this come from?
This comes from a number that's been adjusted over the course of time, and the number comes to, with benefits, $13.94, without benefits, $17.10. And
just so the city's arbitrary.
I'm not sure it's arbitrary. I'm not sure it's arbitrary at all.
I mean, there's got to be a formula.
But that's not the point. They want an exemption, and they've been able to say if there's a hardship, there's an exemption. So my question is, what's the profit hardship? Are they only making, you know, $30 million or $30,000? Are they going to, I mean, that's where this is so loosey-goosey. It's based on trust. And, of course, they like this institution because they really do use, like, a lot of local produce. But the problem is you want local production to survive, but you also want people to survive who are going to earn wages. And that's really what the challenge is. And, you know, Burlington is always out there, you know, with socialist Bernie Sanders initially as their mayor. Now they're still out there. But you know what? It's a direction we're going, I think, as a nation. So I'm not surprised by the fight.
Well, let me just say that, just to be clear, so that people understand, this is at the Burlington airport where these
they're
a vendor at the airport. So this is really about tourism as well. So that's where the mayor has said, this is why I want to make an exception, because we're talking about people coming through. It's a draw.
Right.
It enhances looks at our products that are made here in Vermont.
Right.
So is that not worthy of an exemption? Now, go ahead, Paul Pronovo.
Well, and that's the point I was going to make. We all pretend there's a level playing field for businesses, but the reality is some get tax breaks, some don't. Some get incentivized to be places, some don't. And there are all sorts of reasons for that. It seems in the case here, Burlington wants the Skinny Pancake, and I guess their, I can't resist saying, their sister company, the Chubby Muffin.
That's great.
Didn't you love this story?
I do.
I do love it. To be somehow associated with the place. And obviously they want to have, I guess, sort of a local flavor as people arrive. I mean, sort of the same thing down here in Hyannis. Mm. You know, we wanted to have sort of a tactile feel when you came, that you arrived on Cape Cod. So the murals and the look of it kind of feel like that. I'm guessing this is the same thing, and that's why they don't want something generic like, say, a Dunkin' Donuts. Not to be
loosey-goosey, but you're asking then the employees to sacrifice. Mm. So if it had been a Dunkin' Donuts, they'd be making $17 an hour. Mm. Because it is the Skinny Pancake, they're going to be making $10 an hour. Mm. And remember, who's bearing the cost isn't going to be the airport, isn't going to be the city, because they're going to be making money, isn't going to be Skinny Pancake. But the rationale for the livable wage was that people need to live, too, so they can eat at the Skinny Pancake. I just want to remind you. So there's virtue on both sides. There's no question.
And Arnie, you should mention the fact that there's, you know, some little scuttlebutt about the mayor having relationships, and so that, therefore, you mentioned that because
the mayor who ran got a small donation, but he knows the brother of the owner of Skinny Pancake. I mean, this is Burlington. We're not talking New York City. Everybody knows everybody. I mean, I hate to say this. How do you back away from your neighbor? You know. So I mean, I think that allegation is a little slim pickings here. I think the biggest problem for everyone was that there was confusion at the very beginning whether there would in fact be an exemption that applied to this. So when they were negotiating, when they were doing the competitive bid, when they were signing contracts, nobody really knew what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And that was stupid on the part of the city. I think they should have just made it black and white from the beginning, and then nobody would be in this mix today.
Yeah, well, I'm going to keep an eye on that.
I love the livable wage concept.
Yeah,
it's something we should watch.
It's a very interesting case.
Yes.
Oh, it really is.
All right, so it's back. Holiday Tree in Rhode Island. Robert Wickham.
I'm so ready.
Last year, y'all remember Governor Chafee named the Christmas, what most of us would call Christmas trees, and I'm not a particularly believing person, though of Christian background. He called the big tree, call it the big tree, the big evergreen in the middle of the State House lobby, the Holiday Tree, and all hell broke loose. This was, you know, defaming to the Christian traditions of America and all this stuff. It went on and on. He was on talk shows. Well, this year, trying to avoid the rumpus, he simply stepped out of his office and quickly turned on the tree without telling anybody.
What a coward.
Basically without telling anybody. So there were a few kind of mystified tourist and school children wandering around. You know, I don't know if you've ever been in the Rhode Island State. It's quite dramatic, this great Charles McKim edifice. So they're sort of wandering around. All of a sudden, the light goes on. The lights go on. And the holiday tree, and then the governor made a few remarks, wishing everybody best wishes for the holiday season, and wandered back into his office. But, of course, he couldn't escape controversy. It went all over the country yet again. As some of you may be aware, some of the listeners may be aware, he was on Bill O'Reilly last night defending himself. And it just never stops. But Chafee, who, by the way, is an Episcopalian, as I think everybody in the family is sticking to his guns on these things. I mean, he's very stubborn. He's very soft-spoken, but very stubborn. He thinks to call it a Christmas tree is unfair to the many non-Christians who live around here.
So, Robert, I wrote something. I'm
prepared
for this. Well, here's what I did. I think you should call it a tree of celebrations.
Yeah.
Now Christmas, now Hanukkah, now Kwanzaa, now solstice. To the top of the tree, to the top of the stake.
Well, as a letter writer suggested, he said, hey, Whitcomb, call it the tree of secular excess.
Well, no, give it to everybody. I think you give it to everybody and then let them bitch. You know, I think that's fine.
But I just couldn't believe it that I got about 9,000 letters to the editor. It's all over radio. It's just, you know, because he calls it a holiday tree. Why people care so much about this, I don't know. And, of course, it's almost a cliche to repeat it. The Christmas tree is a pagan invention. But details.
Yes, exactly.
next year they're gonna have the Festivus poll.
Festivus directed.
I'm for Festivus.
I've had phone calls about it, radio cockles, just like last year. But he thought he'd escape it by turning on the light quickly and then getting out of the way.
So, Bob, my question is, was there no program at all? Did he come out and make comments to people who basically were passing by?
Yeah, it was basically he wandered. I wasn't right there, obviously.
Sure.
He basically kind of wandered out of his office and had it turned on and said about, five words and then went back to his
what
office.
A riot, holding the extension cord. Here, I've got it. Plug it.
People wandering, just a few people, not a lot of people, a few people wandering around the lobby, and, they see the lights go on.
What a riot.
And here's the...
He just goes right back. But he was more than willing to go mano a mano with Bill O'Reilly, of course.
Me
enough.
Too. We'll
get more time about it. But,
well, and here's the deal. He couldn't possibly go back after last year.
Yeah.
I mean, last year he called it the holiday tree. If he called it a Christmas tree this year, he'd be accused of flip-flopping. He was stuck with the term.
What people expend their energy on is amazing. He probably needs better political advice. I think the big issue here is so much energy and management time has been expended on what is basically nothing.
Actually, Bob,
so if I were him, I wouldn't have said anything.
You know what?
I
think what I would have said is, you noticed how short and brief I was. You won something.
Yeah.
Just accept it and let's walk away. Come on, boys.
Well, I would say that, when you say, Robert, that this is, not a big deal, it is a big deal for some people because
it feels as though it's
over the top in trying not to acknowledge the Christmas tree, and whether or not it's a pagan symbol or not, it's thought of now culturally as a religious symbol.
It's symbolically very important to people, many of whom are angry about other stuff.
Right. So you have that. And then also, I have to say that I think what made it bad last year was not that he finally called it a holiday tree, is that he messed around for so long and then called it a holiday tree instead of just saying, this is what I'm going to do. You don't like it?
Yeah.
Don't like it.
Exactly.
So it grew in size that it didn't need to be. If he had just addressed it firmly right at the beginning, where have we heard this before?
If I were his political advisor, and I think he ignores most of his political advisors, I think I would have just said a Christmas tree, since everybody calls them Christmas trees, including my Jewish friends, my Muslim friends, my atheist friends. Happy Christmas tree, and then get back to work.
Exactly. Well, I am speaking with Robert Whitcomb. You just heard him, Vice President and Editorial Page Editor of the Providence Journal. Arnie Arneson, host of The Attitude on WNHN, and Paul Pronovo, editor of the Cape Cod Times. And this is the local regional look at stories that went under the radar. No more story that always is under the radar when we talk about the Cape and the islands. Paul Pronovo, are the stories about the homeless. And that surfaced again this week when the police found some homeless camps that they had to clear out.
Right. And, you know, of course, I think the Cape and the Islands rightly are associated with sort of vacation land. This is where people come to kick back in the summer and enjoy a nice vacation. But the reality is there are people here all year round. The Cape has a population of a quarter of a million people. And when you have that many people, you're going to have all the associated societal issues as well, including homelessness. And in Hyannis, that is particularly pronounced. That's largely because most of the Cape's human service agencies are clustered here in Hyannis. So if you need services,
it's sort of the capital of the Cape, really.
Indeed, it really is. So you know, so that's where the folks are, and you know, there's two. I mean, there's several issues at play, obviously, whenever you're talking about the homeless situation, but certainly affordable housing here on the Cape is one of them. Folks who are on the bubble get bounced over the bubble because there's literally, there's very, very little affordable housing, and the housing that there is filled. I mean, there's really not a lot of capacity. And then, of course, you have mental illness, and then something that's very prevalent on the Cape and the Islands, serious addiction issues, and that drives the number high. It's always, we know the folks are out there. You see them walking Main Street every day, but it's always alarming when something like what happened this week occurs, and that's pretty much every winter the police and the human service agencies go out to these so-called homeless camps, these little encampments in the woods, and basically try to get the folks out of there, because it's one thing to be there in the summer and it's certainly not good living conditions then, but as you head into these the winter and the dangerous temps, they simply can't be there. So they counted somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 camps that they went to tell people, we're going to have to bring you somewhere else and force the issue, and then they clean them out.
But Paul, what do you do?
Where do they go? What's the breakdown of where they're taken? I mean, some are taken to mental hospitals if there are any left. You know, some are taken to, I don't know, you know, warming centers. I mean, where do most of these people go when they're scooped up?
Right. Well, there are a tier of shelters. There's the Housing Assistance Corporation on the Cape runs the NOAA shelter, which is sort of the main catch point for homeless folks. It's right here in downtown Hyannis. It's right behind the Salvation Army.
Oh, yeah.
There are other facilities as well. Billy Bishop, a former homeless person himself who now is a homeless advocate and runs Homeless Not Helpless, he runs a facility for folks who are just one step away from really getting back on their feet. And it's, in fact, an incredible program, and Billy's incredibly dynamic. So they run that spectrum to vouchers for a lot of the motels in the area, of course, are vacant at this time of the year. So there's federal vouchers. And then a lot of the churches in the area have worked out arrangements where they try to bring people in. They had a little dust up with the fire marshal a couple years ago because the living conditions are not always appropriate for folks, but I mean, that's basically
pallets in the church or in the rectories or
in the basements, essentially, yeah.
But one of the big problems, and you noted this in your story, is that most shelters, almost everywhere, has a code of behavior.
Right.
And if you have an addiction problem, if you have an anger problem, if you have a mental illness problem, you only have a tent out in the woods because nobody wants to take you. And there are only so many beds at a mental hospital and so many people that can actually get into that. And that's where they're between a rock and a hard place.
Right.
And that, I think, is the greatest challenge because, one, they even said that the police have done such a remarkable job. There's a greater sense of compassion and understanding, and they really want to work with these folks and not make them afraid of them. But at the same time, a lot of these people are there for a reason, and that's because they can't comply with the code of behavior. And I don't know what you do for them because I don't know if there's a place where the code doesn't apply.
Mm.
Well, a lot of those folks slide back into the woods.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I have to say that I want to just give some credit to our colleague, Sean Corcoran, who has done at WCAI, who's done several years ago 30 stories on poverty and homelessness, including these kinds of scenarios that you've depicted in your daily story here, Paul Pronovo. And his great work was awarded, including a DuPont Columbia Award. Mm-hmm. And also, we on Boston Public Radio interviewed the author and the doctor profiled in her book, Island Practice, Dr. Tim Leppery. And part of the book was about how much you know, goes into the woods and finds these people. He knows where they are and treats them, you know, taking care of them because it exists.
It
and
does.
That's Nantucket, where we're now not talking about millionaires, but billionaires. Yeah. And the population exists.
Heaven.
Yeah. So it's something that's, you know, definitely under the radar. And it's important that, Paul, you guys down at the Cape Cod Times keep alerting us to it.
Sure. And it's a serious issue. You know, down here, we're well aware of it. It's a problem. The good news is the Cape and the Islands are blessed with so many people who are out there advocating, helping, getting people shelter, finding paths to success, as many as they can. Some folks are going to slide back into the woods. It's simple as that.
Exactly.
But the more folks they can get out of there, the better.
All right, we're taking in a mix of the week's news with a regional twist, and I'm joined by Paul Pronovo of the Cape Cod Times, Arnie Arneson representing New Hampshire, and Robert Whitcomb of the Providence Journal. I'm Callie Crossley. The conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Callie Crossley. We're going over the week's local news with a focus on the stories coming out of New England. I'm joined by Paul Pronovo of the Cape Cod Times, New Hampshire's Arnie Arneson, and Robert Whitcomb of the Providence Journal. Got to go right to you, Arnie Arneson. The story about Stacey Lawson and
Charles as before and now Stacey as of now, yes.
Yeah, resigned and then said, "Well, no, maybe not," and it's a whole controversy.
So let me take you back. New Hampshire has 400 legislators. We pay them $100 a year, and most people couldn't pick them out of a lineup. Okay, so let's start with that as our premise.
Been in lineup.
Well, it turns out she has. So this woman got elected, or this transgender person got elected from Nashua. No one knew very much about this person. They had moved to Nashua a couple years ago. It turned out that in their previous life, they were known as Charles. In their current life, they're now known as Stacey. They ran as Stacey, and no one really vetted this candidate. The Democratic Party just wants someone with a pulse. The Republican Party wants someone with a pulse. And if they show up, hallelujah, and they can never ask them any questions. Well, it turns out that and here's the problem. Who was supposed to find out that she's an ex-felon? I mean, this is what the problem is.
It
turns out you cannot hold a seat or run for office if you are an ex-felon who has not completed your time under your prison sentence or something. There's a term of art that no one even knows what the term of art means, but it suggests that until you've been just discharged, you know, appropriately from prison, you can't run. Well, the problem is she was found to be a felon in 2008. She had a suspended sentence. She has good behavior for 10 years, and if she somehow breaks that good behavior, she can be thrown back in prison. Well, does that mean that her prison term is ended? Or does it mean that we have to wait 10 years so no one knows? And on top of that, she never told anyone. And I talked.
And no one asked.
Well, no.
Well, it's not something that would just come up in conversation.
Well, now it will. Now it will. Thank you very much. This
was
a teachable moment.
Yes.
Right. This was a.
We should say what the crime was. Credit card fraud.
And there's some other fraud problems too. So she's got a potpourri. Yeah. But here's a couple of things. I talked to a reporter, and the reporter said, "Let me just say something, Arnie. We did an investigation of her under Stacey." Not under her name when she was when she was using a male's name. So they never were able to connect those dots, which they would have. And this really is a teachable moment because I think both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party will ask people to run, but they are going to then say to them, tell us about your past. Do you have a criminal past? And when you have 800 people running, remember, that's how many, the likelihood is you will find someone from every walk of life, you know, teeth, a felony, you know, all those things. And she has now decided that she will, in fact, step down. So the problem, I think, for Nashua is that this is the second time this has happened in about 10 years. The last time they elected a Republican who, it turned out, had Facebook stuff about how he wanted to kill cops. And that wasn't a good idea for someone that you had just elected. So Tom Alsier stepped down, and now we have Stacey, who is our first transgendered, elected official who has stepped down before she was even seated.
What district is this in Nashua? I mean,
I don't know.
What's the constituency? What are they? they have these problems?
Well, it's not about problems. It's about not knowing who you've elected, and it is just too difficult. When you get paid $100 a year, you're not going to spend $1,000 to run, number one. Number two, no one's going to spend a lot of money to run against you. And on top of that, she had served as a selectman in her ward, so people were familiar with her, and no one, again, had ever asked the question, are you a felon, or have you ever done time? And I think the problem is she also didn't offer it. And for full disclosure, it probably would have behooved her to maybe tell someone, because then she could have won and felt legitimate about her winning. Instead, it felt like a bait and switch.
Well, and that's the thing when you
when you run for office, you know, the higher you go, the more you have to disclose. And maybe it wasn't a big deal when you were in a town committee setting.
Exactly.
But if you're going to run for a larger seat, then you gotta own up. And I think the responsibility is on her to put this forward. You know, it's a little unfortunate the reporters didn't look deeper. I mean, boy, when you have someone who literally has two identities, that's the perfect thing you want to look at to see how things mesh.
And she should have known that as a transgender person running for office, that more scrutiny was going to come to her no matter what happened. So she was either going to sacrifice her privacy, which she chose not to do, or ultimately, in this time, sacrifice her credibility, which she has to have to do.
And let me just
That's what surprises me, because she's transgendered, that there wouldn't have been more investigation. Core of my query is really that.
But why would you do what, you know, why? Yeah, why? Not, that isn't necessarily.
Just curiosity, I guess. Yeah.
No, I think what I would say is that because New Hampshire got a lot of national attention after electing the women in Congress.
Right, exactly.
And then the next story we heard was, in addition, there's a transgender person. Now, at that point, because there's so much national scrutiny, maybe that's, you know, if that hadn't happened, she
would have gotten notoriety because she was the first transgendered elected person. There's no question about it. She should have known it. She should have taken notice of it. And the one question I have about the media and even about my own party is that what they should have done is, if her name is Stacy, they could have asked her, what was your previous name?
Mm-hmm.
Because the likelihood is she has been operating under two different names.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, just a social media note, she while she was trying to figure out whether she was going to resign or not, first she said she wouldn't, then she said no. Then she put the question out on her Facebook page and asked the community to comment.
And I'm not on Facebook.
You know, and say, do you think I should resign or not? So I thought that was kind of an interesting way of approaching the constituents. But there you go. All right.
Well, it's interesting, too, that they can just the way you can reach out to your constituency, regardless of the story. I mean, you really can get right up close and personal with folks in doing something like this, although probably not a good idea to decide if you're going to hold a state representative seat by how many likes you get.
And I think we're gonna have to finally define what does it mean by final discharge.
Right.
You know, this is the new term of art that we never had to apply to any of the legislators, but now we do.
Well, and it should be noted that for a number of people, they thought discharge meant when you leave the prison, that's it, or when that's done, so that. That in fact probation would not be considered part of that. So, but
and
that
I
has
can
to be
argue
decided.
Against that.
No,
so,
and others are now. But I'm just saying that was a legitimate way of considering discharge, and that's how it was.
Well,
looked
it was
at.
A celebration of diversity, so it was a wonderful thing, no matter what.
All right, back down your way, Paul Pronovost, because you have had so many animal stories this year. This is a kind of a sad one, in that the cold water down there is shocking. Turtles, and they're endangered.
Right. Well, I mean, obviously, a lot of animals migrate up and down the coast, depending on the weather, you know, birds, fish, sharks, what have you, and turtles are among them. Not all the turtles apparently get the memo when it's time to go south. And so some of them hang around a little too long. They hang around, they swim around, they eat fish, and they eat whatever. And then the water temperature drops dramatically around this time of the year, late November into early December, and they literally become paralyzed. They become cold stunned, and they wash up on the beach, and you see them in large numbers. This week we had upwards of 20 turtles of all different types, loggerheads, Kemp Ridley, just washed up on the beach, frozen and paralyzed. The good news is we're so accustomed to this phenomenon and can almost set your watch to when it's going to happen. You have spotters out there, and then the Mass Audubon Society is on the scene in a hurry. They bring these turtles in to a variety of rehab places, from the National Marine Life Center in Buzzards Bay to the New England Aquarium. And essentially, they warm the turtles up, And then they bring them down south. So it's actually a pretty good deal, ultimately, if the for the turtles, if they survive. And this week, it's a good news story, they did.
So they put them in a truck and drive them to South Carolina or something and dump them off there.
I'm frozen right now, and I'd like to go to Florida. can I put my request in?
Not unless you're crawling along on the beach.
Too bad.
Put them on JetBlue.
I would like to point out that the natural inclination of someone trying to help if you saw a paralyzed turtle would be to put them back in their what you think is their natural habitat, which is the water. And just for anyone listening, that is not the thing to do now. Do not do that. You cover them with seaweed and mark the location and call Mass Audubon. So that, I thought, was very important information for folks to know.
We should get that in the paper as sort of a notice. They wash up here sometimes, too.
Oh, well, you should put that in. Yeah. It is in the Cape Cod Times. Paul Pronovo did it already. Yeah. All right, over to you in Rhode Island and Robert Whitcomb. This has been an issue that I heard about, and now it seems like it's a little bit hushed up. They say it's resolved. That's the National Grid workers who did massive amounts of overtime and work following Tropical Storm Sandy, and they weren't getting paid. Now, National Grid said
they were working a tremendous amount of overtime. It was 16 hours a day, and they weren't getting paid. I guess they are now belatedly getting paid, but there's quite a rumpus about it, which raises some other issues, I think, which is I think these utilities don't have enough people. I think to boost the profits,
they
don't have enough people. And of course, the infrastructure is falling apart anyway, not only electrical, but otherwise. And so a lot of these they do everything on an emergency basis. You know, we actually on Long Island, for example, in New Jersey, they were actually bringing in some military people to help with this from as far away as California, because the utilities don't have enough people. On a good week, they don't have enough people, and they're just working them long, long hours. And then when hurricane or superstorm, or whatever you want to call it, Sandy came along, a tremendous pressure all over the Northeast to fix these lines. And so they just pushed. I heard some people were working 20 hours, overtime, like one day, which is crazy. It's very unsafe. You know, this work takes considerable prudence and care. You don't want to electrocute somebody or have them fall off a pole. So it's a real problem.
I'm going to defend
National Grid.
And
not just in this case, I think all over the country, and the decaying electrical system. NSTAR had a big outage.
We know about that.
But here's the problem with the story, though. It's according to this story that you wrote, it said that there was a new computer payroll system that was instituted November 1st. This overwhelmed the system. They weren't prepared for this. What I don't understand is how did it get so out of control? All you had to do, you have the phone numbers of every single person you sent to New York to respond to Sandy, call them up saying, look, there's a problem with our system. We'll get you the check. Not a problem. That this should have gone to the union and to the press and to the people. Someone at National Grid was really foolish because
somebody
by not responding quickly.
I mean, they're overwhelmed. They probably don't have enough middle management people at National Grid either to process this stuff.
But Robert, I want to point out that reading the comments to your story, there are people that said, payroll system schmooey, that this is kind of a problem that's been going on before that.
And that would be a problem.
And it didn't have anything to do with Sandy. It was just exacerbated because of Sandy.
I think I'm kind of alluding to that, or I've said that. I think this is a problem of understaffing, of sort of lack of, if you will, administrative infrastructure. Some of these companies are very lucrative to many investors, but they are not being properly treated. I'm giving my editorial position now, I'm sorry, but they are not being properly treated as they should be as public utilities, public services. So I think there's a broader problem here, which Sandy just sort of exemplified.
So Bob, in my state, I'm not sure if this is true in Rhode Island. In my state, if you don't get paid during a normal pay period, you get fined. You have to pay double the amount.
It's against the law.
Exactly. Yeah. So the best way to resolve this is fine the suckers. I mean, that's my answer, because that's exactly what you're supposed to do. If there was a problem, why didn't you give them adequate notice? If there's
these
a pattern
write
problem,
emergency checks too.
Exactly.
We had a problem here once because there was a tornado in Memphis, so that some FedEx stuff didn't come in. Some checks from Dallas or wherever, and they were prepared to cut people emergency checks. in a local bank here. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget it because I was sort of the only one in the executive offices that day. It was a Friday, and it looked like a running. But we would do anything to get people paid that day when they were owed the money, including emergency, you know, transfers of money between banks.
It's interesting when, well, I just want to say that, you know, when you have these big utilities, the larger you are, the more likely you're going to have an issue like this. And and last year in Massachusetts, when we had the significant power outages, not once but twice, and there was a lot of scrutiny on the big utilities, folks started looking at some of the smaller municipalities, and actually some not so small, that have their own municipal light utilities, their own light companies. Mm-hmm. And those inevitably were faster to respond, got your power back on.
Absolutely, Paul.
Generally speaking, the rates are low.
Maybe we need more locally based, even, you know, locally owned, municipally owned utilities. Distributed energy, I think they call it. Mm-hmm. Distributed
electricity. The issue, of course, is the big utilities own the infrastructure. They own the wires.
Yeah.
And so they say, you want to have a local light company here? Great.
And
buy the equipment.
And the extent of the devastation of Sandy to Far Rockaway and to New York and to Long Island is so overwhelming. They were bringing people in from Canada.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And that's one of the things we should keep in mind. And that's one of the reasons why National Grid, I think, was so foolish, because this is such a high-profile event that the first thing they should have done is sent a message to these incredible people who are spending 16 hours a day working saying, look, the check will be there. We'll figure it out.
Right.
I apologize.
Yes,
that's
because those people have been working
really hard to get
the lights.
Hard.
Yeah, well, they've been working hard to get the lights on. The folks there are suffering, so enough can't be said for those workers who have extended themselves, including working over the holiday, so to help those people get their lights back on. All right, finally, I think it's finally anyway. I am surprised, Arnie, by this. I am surprised by this ruling against or in favor of supporting Maine's Governor LePage. He said he was going to take the mural down, the labor mural, because he thought it was offensive and against businesses, that it supported labor inappropriately.
All right, so let me take you back. It was back in March of 2011. They elected a guy named LePage.
Minority votes. It was a split election.
We'll keep apologizing. Anyway, he decided that he did not like the mural that was in the Department of Labor because it depicted labor. It showed the stories of working people, you know, in the shirtwaist fire, perhaps, or perhaps, you know, Rosie the Riveter, you know, and all those things. That was the story of the struggle of labor. And he said, this sends a wrong message. Imagine if you're an employer and you walk into this place and you see these pictures of poor workers, and we're open for business, not open for workers. So he had them remove this big mural. And then people went crazy because they said, this is the Department of Labor, not the Department of Management. This was something that was commissioned. The federal government gave us $60,000 to do it. It was vetted. A guy from the University of Maine even suggested the panels because he's a labor professor. And it turns out the reason why LePage won is they decided that it wasn't a free speech issue for the artist, but that it was a government speech issue. And therefore, according to the judge, this government speech meant that they could decide what they wanted to do. And if you don't like the government speech, you vote it out. That was the remedy. The remedy is, if you don't like LePage's speech, in this case removing these panels, then you better figure out what to do at the next election.
And vote
him out.
Very
interesting.
Yeah, it really is, because, as you said, many people went to court on behalf of the artist, whose name is Judy Taylor. And I thought this was going to be, you know, I just can't believe it.
What's worse is he took them down and he hid them. We don't even know where the murals are. I mean, this is even more bizarre. But he said, well, you know, I'll find another place for them. So one of the attorneys said, okay, now that we've done this, where's the other place? Can we make a recommendation, put it in the museum and somewhere? And he'll say, I'll get to it. So this is really even more crazy than just removing them. It's that now they're hidden.
Well, the Department of Labor has said he'll have to pay for it. If
from the Rockefeller Center that John D. Rockefeller Jr. had taken down because they're too commie.
There we go. Playing the same fiddle.
The Department of Justice or Labor had said, you know, the federal folks had said, listen, you're going to have to repay us if you for the murals if they really are gone. I don't think they're gone if they're somewhere.
They
so they'll probably
somewhere.
Show well.
Right. In little pieces.
Hey, but victory for him. He won. So there you go.
And actually, here's the good news. If you look at the election of 2012, there was major political changes. And, I mean, LePage is grateful that he's got a four-year term, but the handwriting is on the wall that this mural is just one example.
Well,
and here's the thing, too. I just one last thing I want to mention.
Got 15 seconds.
Got it. Paintings are one thing, but they're symbols. Policy are what really is driving politics, and that's what the politicians are elected for or unelected, and that's why they probably ruled the way they did.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
you got it.
All right. Well, again, another rich and exciting discussion with you folks. We've been going over the week's news, focusing on Greater New England, and I've been speaking with Paul Pronovo, editor of the Cape Cod Times, Robert Whitcomb, vice president and editorial page editor of the Providence Journal, and Arnie Arneson, host of The Attitude, a daily radio show out of Concord, New Hampshire. Thanks all.
Ciao, you guys.
Great weekend, bye. Everybody. Happy weekend.
Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can find us on the web at wgbhnews.org/BPR. I'm Callie Crossley. Boston Public Radio is a production of WGBH Radio.